Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Now, as we enter our third year of living and working in a pandemic, navigating the changes in workplace dynamics and values, it hasn't seemed to be getting any easier. My guest today may be able to help us think through how to cope with and adapt to the changes occurring within at the workplace and within the workforce. Hetal Doshi is an organizational psychologist and certified professional coach. She's also the CEO of OPsych. Hetal, it's so lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Okay, so I was thinking that perhaps we could begin our conversation today by understanding a little bit more about what an organizational psychologist does or what it is, because I have to say I haven't come across that many organizational psychologists in my career. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the role of an organizational psychologist.
That's true. There are very few of us in Malaysia, and majority of them who would be organizational psychologists would typically be academics as well, doing, you know, really good research work that is very important for organizations. So the role of an organizational psychologist, if I can use something called the butterfly effect to explain it. So organizations go through a caterpillar to a cocoon in hope of becoming a butterfly, right? All have an aspiration. So the role of an organizational psychologist is to be very clear about the aspiration or the butterfly of an organization, not only from a goal perspective, but also a visual perspective. What is the organization's desire, who it wants to be? As a psychologist, our job is to be super clear about that, because sometimes that's not crystal clear. And our next job, more importantly, would be to identify all the psychological strategies to get there. So what happens in the workplace is that most of the time we have something called business strategies. But according to research, there's a McKinsey report that came out, 70% of organizations will fail in their pursuit because they have business strategies, but they don't have psychological strategies to get there. It's kind of like losing weight. You know, we have a goal, that's our butterfly. All of us, there's no difference, right, between one person to another person in terms of setting goals. But there are a lot of strategies that will actually help us to eventually get there. And there's an easy approach or there's a difficult approach. So we try to bring the easy, more easy approach so that we are not in the cocoon for too long.
I like the idea of using psychological strategies and approaches to address the workplace and the dynamics within the workplace, because I think very frequently we forget that we're all people working side by side together to achieve a goal for the organization. It's always about business strategy and how do we get there and think about the dollars and cents of the steps. And I'm just wondering, how did you come to be in this role, Hetal? As you said, you know, a lot of academics, a lot of organizational psychologists are academics. How did you become passionate about understanding psychology of a workplace?
Right. So, I mean, just something that you said earlier really resonated, and it was very thought-provoking. Like, sometimes we forget that we're human beings in a workplace. Like, how do we even forget that, right? So thanks for sharing that. It's so super true. So when I was deciding what I really wanted to do, I wasn't clear at all. My dad told me to sit in a room and figure it out until I, you know, only come out of the room until I figured it out. And he gave me this book, and it was a British Council book of careers. So I sat down and he said, just cancel everything that you don't want to be doing. So I canceled. It was a pretty thick book, like pottery, librarian, all kinds of things, right, in detail, and cancel everything. And only come out when you're down to like two or three choices. And when I came out of the room, I was like, okay, I found my choices. And he's like, what are they? And I said, you know, accountant or psychologist. And he was like, it's totally different. One is numbers and one is people. What are you thinking, right? But I did enjoy both very much. And interestingly, psychology has so much to do with not accounting, but a lot of stats, because you want to take a very statistical, quantitative approach to really understanding, especially an organization, right? So you want to be able to understand it from a much larger perspective. And, you know, it, obviously statistics becomes very important. So I chose psychology, but how I chose organizational psychology was because I come from a family of entrepreneurs. And so the clinical part didn't really excite me because it was, you know, a lot of it was about pathology and illness. Whereas organizational psychology was very exciting and, you know, sassy because it was all about, you know, an organization. Majority of my family members are entrepreneurs. And so every time they used to discuss stuff in the workplace or in running their businesses, they used to talk about the challenges that they experience. And I thought, of course, we need psychology to be able to address that. And that's when I thought, yeah, this is a much better fit for my, you know, genetics, I guess, and my personality. And, you know, my first job really was the one that sealed the deal for me. My first job was to get people out of their jobs, which was a very horrifying, painful experience.
So, sorry, to help people get out of their jobs, what does that mean?
Outplacement, yeah.
Oh,
have you?
Yes.
Seen that movie called Up in the Air? I think that's the movie that everyone, whenever I talk about this, people
so
are like, what?
Are you George Clooney?
I was, yes, very much so.
Okay.
You know.
So for the benefit of those who haven't watched the movie, it's about a consultant, a management consultant that comes in and helps organizations downsize and let people go. Is that correct? Did I encapsulate that? Okay.
And or right size, as they call it as well these
right
days,
size.
Melissa, whatever that means. But actually, there is a terminology for that. So when I was tasked to do that, yes, we have management consultants, and this is why it's also good to have psychologists on board as well, because it's a massive psychological experience, right? It's after death of a loved one, divorce and public speaking, losing your job would be the next most stressful event that you could ever experience, because it is about a death. It is about separation, like, you know, divorce of sorts. And it is that sense of betrayal that comes together with it. So what was very interesting for me was not the job itself, but the kind of people that, and the kind of reactions that I experienced. And it was particularly this one guy who I experienced, who actually didn't go, after he had been outplaced, he still kept going, he still kept dressing up every morning and leaving his house and pretending he still had a job just so that he wouldn't worry his wife who was pregnant with the third child. There was one of that case, and then there was others who were, you know, becoming full-fledged entrepreneurs. And what I realized that there were people who were distressed, there were people who were stagnant, so we call them the flighters, the freezers, but there were the ones who were very ambitious and going out there and creating whole new worlds. So I was very interested to see how people could end up using this experience as, you know, something to create better possibilities for themselves rather than being stuck in the cocoon for very, very long periods of time. The data that we showed was that after a year, everybody did well for themselves, but some took a day and some took a whole year. So what I wanted to do was to reduce the suffering, the experience of suffering in any kind of experience that a person would have in their lifetime at work. So I got really excited about understanding the science behind experiences and wellness.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad that, I mean, it's an interesting career choice, but I'm wondering what kind of challenges it comes with. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking, you know, just given the priorities that organizations tend to place sometimes above employee well-being, would that present a challenge for you as an organizational psychologist working with corporations sometimes?
So I think what are some of the challenges would be, why does an organization actually want to embark on, you know, psychological designs or psychological strategies in the workplace? Really understanding the intent behind it can be really valuable. And sometimes the disclosure is not very upfront and transparent. Sometimes when they ask us to come on board, it could be because they, you know, want to outplace people, which is something that we may or may not recommend, because you just want to be very transparent and honest about it. However, I'm finding that in Malaysia, majority of the time, the intent of CEOs or business leaders is pretty solid and pretty well intended. Sometimes it gets lost in translation, but we like to capture the why and make sure that it's explicitly put up that Hatel, for example, is supporting a particular client because of a particular agenda, because we do not want to have a bad reputation at the end of the day that when somebody meets a psychologist,
right,
they're like, okay, beware. So we want that when you meet a psychologist, you know that everybody is in excellent, safe hands, and that there's ethics and integrity involved. I'm sure organizations do that, but especially when we are around, we want to make sure that the intent is very, very clear, ethical integrity as well.
When you, so early in the conversation at the start, you said, you know, it's very important for organizations, businesses to be very clear about what they want, right? Who they are and what kind of organization they want to be. Sometimes maybe that's not clear because they themselves are not clear about what they want that to be. How do you work through with organizations to identify what it is that they want to achieve, or is that something you have to kind of unpeel, like a therapist in a therapy session, you have to peel back the layers?
Absolutely. I mean, the Spice Girls song is such an amazing song. It goes, you know, tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I want a zigzag. So, you know, that idea of lack of clarity. So, and also, by the way, like sometimes actually organizations are very clear, but when we ask them the question, they actually know it, but they forgot about it. And I can easily remind them because I've heard it before. They're like, oh yeah, that's correct. That's actually what we wanted. So this is called the butterfly. And yes, absolutely, there are specific techniques to be able to understand it, not only from a one, you know, one-liner, this is what we want, but also a visual of what it looks like and a narration to be able to explain it so that it's consistently understood across the entire organization. So yes, that's definitely one of the things that we do. And I think that can be a challenge sometimes. Yeah, there are a few other challenges. That could be one, definitely.
Well, I want to talk to you about the most recent and pressing challenge, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to take a quick break, but let's come back after and discuss all the changes that the pandemic has forced us to address in the workplace. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to The Future is Female. We'll see you after this. Welcome back to The Future is Female. I'm Melissa Idris and I'm speaking to organizational psychologist Hetal Doshi. She's the CEO of OPSYCH. And Hetal, just before the break, we talked a little bit about the challenges you face as an organizational psychologist. But I would like to understand a little bit better what, in your perspective and in your experience in this job, you found that the pandemic has forced organizations to address things that perhaps were, you know, long-standing issues that pushed aside, but now have had to, you know, it's come to the fore and we've had to address it.
Yeah, I think obviously prior to the pandemic, everyone was talking about digitalization and transforming. And because of the pandemic, one of the things that was forced to be addressed was transformation, not for the sake of, but from its core. So really, really shifting the way that we work from a very truthful perspective, rather than, you know, we have an existing policy, we try to stick with it. So transformation at its core is definitely something that organizations have had to address. Self-transformation, team transformation, and the entire organization as well. So transforming in order to perform has become a very important part of a skill. So I think organizations want to transform, but we don't realize that it's actually a psychological skill that needs to be learned. We don't just transform, there's actually a science to be able to understand how to do this. And organizations talk about it, but they do not upskill people on a skill called how do you transform. So that's one thing that has they're forced to address. But Melissa, I think I'm really impressed by a lot of organizations in Malaysia, because they're actually putting in a lot of effort to figure this out. The second thing is well-being. There is one thing called mental health for sure. I'd like to stick to, you know, well-being at its core, because the mental health is mental health, but the aspiration, the butterfly, is called well-being. So I'd rather talk about the aspiration rather than, you know, mental health per se, because that's what we really want, right? So let's talk about what we really want. The third thing is that has come up in our data is organizational justice. So it's interesting, right? It's called organizational justice and respect. It's one of the factors that has come up as the highest level of risk that needs to be addressed. And this is where, you know, for example, if you're a working mom and you have to deal with like the kids and being at home as well, unfortunately, it's not, you know, the same kind of responsibilities maybe that a mom and a dad take equally, and mom may take a bit more, and you know, so then, you know, when it comes to coming back to the workplace, you don't feel that you can cope with that, but then you're penalized for it. So things like that, or certain functions like sales, for example, sales forces need to go back on the field, whereas their counterparts, their colleagues, get to work from home, or not simply not being able to articulate what their stresses are of working from home. Like, for example, I don't have Wi-Fi, I'm staying in, you know, a rural area and stuff like that. You cannot expect. So organizational justice and respect used to be something that people used to speak about and say, you know, on the side, like, you know, go for lunch, talk about it. But now it's really coming up full blown through whistleblowing, putting it up on social media, talking to media and saying that we're not happy with certain things that are going on. That has become like a truth that has to be addressed. And lastly, the voice, I guess, of people are things that really beginning to matter. It's just amazing. It's really amazing being in the industry for 20 years and seeing.
I really love this that you pointed out about organizational justice. It's absolutely true. Sometimes I think maybe these are things that have been brewing under the surface, not quite spoken out loud, maybe open secrets within an organization. But now that the pandemic has forced, you know, that certain inequalities come to light, certain injustices come to light within a workplace, within a workforce, that organizations are forced to respond accordingly. And the way they respond, I think, feeds into, as you said, the well-being of the workforce employees. And again, you know, organizational justice also plays a big part of the well-being. How do you encourage organizations to respond correctly, or to respond in a manner that is, I guess, significant or allows for change? Because as you said, more often than not, sometimes organizations fail to take into consideration the psychological strategies that come with dealing with the workforce. How would you respond to them?
I love that question. Actually, the principles and philosophies to it, yeah. And what we've realized is that number one, being, you know, calm and clear rather than chaotic and creating confusion. That's definitely one approach. A second approach would be evidence-based rather than opinions or highest paid person's opinion. You know, so you want to use
highest
evidence.
Paid person's opinion. I like that. Yeah,
it's actually called HIPPO. So you don't want to be a HIPPO. It's called highest income paid person's opinion. Yeah. But you want to take an evidence-based approach, which is evidence from the community rather than committees, and evidence from research-based practices as well, because the pandemic could be one you know, challenging experience that humanity is experiencing now, but there are many episodes that humanity has experienced, and evidence gives us ideas of how to do that. Also, I think I really love this one, taking a very all-inclusive approach rather than an immunity-based approach, meaning sometimes some departments or some leaders have immunity to, you know, certain things that are supposed to be done from an organization-wide perspective, like as certain SOPs, there's immunity for some of them versus, you know, and not for others. So some principles would be like, you know, all on board rather than immunity given to the privilege of sorts as well. And also, you know, the last part would be a very, very important part, which would be not doing things out of increasing motivation only in an organization, but decreasing the risk and eliminating the risk that you put on them. So a lot of organizations are like, okay, how do I motivate my people? And I'm like, no, don't worry about motivation. What are we doing to demotivate them? Eliminate that as well. You can't add on drama and then help get them to be motivated. So remove the drama and at the same time increase motivation as well.
That
when I say drama, I don't mean...
Sorry, what did you say about drama?
Sorry, when I say drama, I don't mean it in a bad way. Yeah, I just mean it in, you know, it is very dramatic an experience. Yeah. Sorry, you were saying?
Yeah, so I hear you about the drama. Anything that causes us distress or any kind of, you know, disconcerting element to the workplace distracts from what we would rather be doing, which is being productive and doing our jobs.
That's an even better explanation than what I had. Yeah, it's a form of absolute distraction from the butterfly. Very well said, yeah.
So can I ask you about motivation? Because I think that's really interesting, removing the elements of demotivation. And one of the things I think many of us can relate to during this pandemic is the changes in our morale. Good days and bad days, good periods and bad periods at work. How is that, as an organizational psychologist, is that something that you're seeing triggered by a pandemic? And how should we respond to the changing morale of an employee particularly?
Yeah, so one of the things that we advise clients is not to take a blanket approach. For example, the morale could be going down because our data actually shows that motivation is still very high. That's interesting, but ability may be compromised, energy may be compromised, and also creation of opportunities. So I'm motivated, yeah, I still want to get back to work and stuff like that, but maybe I'm not creating more opportunities to interact with people, so on and so forth. So again, an evidence-based approach. The second thing is that we try to take a team-based approach rather than individuals in the organization. So we get teams together, and we get them to open up based on the data that we have about their experiences. What becomes very interesting is that the outcome of these team conversations would be, from a leadership perspective, what can I do for you that's within my control and is a low-hanging fruit that I'm not doing? So you tell me rather than I figure a million things out. So you tell me a low-hanging fruit within my control, can immediately do it for you. The individuals within the team, they say, okay, as a team, this is what we should be doing rather than waiting for everyone else that is within our control and is low-hanging fruits. And the individuals listen to each other, and the third part of it is that they all give each other some advice and wisdom, and they walk away with the last part, which is, hey, what can I do that is within my control that I have not yet done, but I know I should do it. I should really do that. So it's a very holistic, leader, team, individual approach. And interestingly, just talking helps significantly.
Talking, connection, right? Communication, of course, definitely. Hetal, in the few minutes that we have left, I want to bring the conversation back to your role, which is to help organizations through a very challenging period of change, of transformation. And you mentioned a little earlier in the conversation, perhaps at the beginning, that sometimes organizations struggle and they may fail to do so. And I noticed that you've worked with a lot of the big names. You've worked with Google and with Petronas and with Malaysia Airlines, working through some of the organizational changes and transformations that they may have been through. What has your experience been in terms of figuring out what makes an organization more successful at change and transformation? It's a big question to end on.
I think it's clarity of outcome, I would say the butterfly, and the consistency of being able to get there. So organizations that do the best don't only focus on the pandemic, yeah? They're very future oriented, and they're saying, okay, let's begin this process from now, and let's do this consistently over a period of time and across the board as well. So very clear about the butterfly. And I have to give credit to Malaysian organizations, Malaysian leaders. I know there are a lot of things that people say about Malaysia or leaders. It's really good effort. And the thing that is very hard, though, is this consistency. So I would say definitely, I think successful organizations are very consistent in making sure that there's evidence about people's experiences and consistently bringing people together to resolve these particular experiences that could be a bit more challenging. Consistency. Yeah, organizations are consistent. Consistently good, not consistently bad, but consistently good, I think do the best, yeah.
Thank you, Hetal, for joining us on the show today. I appreciate your time today and very happy to have spoken to an organizational psychologist for the first time on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me as well. I really appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Hetal Doshi, a CEO of OPSYCH. And that's all we have for you on this episode of The Future is Female. I will be back with you same time next week. I will see you then. Thank you so much for watching and good night.